Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz in Nogales, Mexico. On the NewsHour tonight, a bipartisan majority in the House passes legislation that could result in a U.S. TikTok ban if its Chinese owners don't sell up.
And it's official. The race for the White House is a rematch of 2020 after President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump clinched their party's nominations.
And the dangerous journey migrant children take, many on their own, seeking safety in the United States.
How did you know where to go or who to go with?
We got to know a group and we started trusting each other and helping each other.
Welcome to the NewsHour. The U.S. House voted overwhelmingly today to pass a bill that could ban TikTok here in the U.S. unless the app cuts ties with China. The bill now heads to the Senate, where its fate is at the moment unclear. Last night, we heard from the lead sponsors of the bill about why the legislation is necessary. Tonight, we hear from an opposing voice, and for that, we're joined by David Green, Civil Liberties Director and Senior Staff Attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Mr. Green, thanks so much for being with us. And you, as I understand it, oppose this bill on First Amendment grounds. We spoke last night with the lead sponsors of that legislation, as I mentioned, Congressman Gallagher and Krishnamoorthy. And Congressman Krishnamoorthy said of China's practices that there's no First Amendment right to espionage. There's no First Amendment right to harm our national security. Why is he wrong, in your view?
He's not thinking about the First Amendment rights of U.S. people who want to use TikTok and their right to communicate with each other through it and to receive information from TikTok in the way they receive it now. U.S. people certainly have a right to use communications tools like TikTok to get information from them and to put out and to use them to disseminate their own information. So I understand that Representative Krishnamoorthy is very concerned about the First Amendment rights of China, but that's really not what we're concerned about. We're concerned about the First Amendment rights of U.S. users.
Doesn't China present a special case? The FBI director, Christopher Wray, said that China is the defining threat of this generation, and the Chinese Communist Party requires Chinese companies to share information and user data upon request. That's the perceived threat that TikTok poses.
Well, that doesn't really make, I defer to the FBI director on the threat posed by China in particular, but I will note that China is not unique in requiring its companies to provide information to them upon request. The U.S. does much of the same thing through national security letters and through surveillance conducted under Executive Order 12333. There's a whole congressional debate going on now about the a proposed renewal of Section 702 surveillance. So the U.S. has many of these same tools. China is not unique among nations in requiring companies located in it to provide internet user data. Now, if China does pose some particular threats, the U.S. can react to it. The question is whether forcing the sale or banning this platform from operating as it currently operates is the properly tailored way of addressing that threat. And what we're saying is that it's not, or at least the government hasn't so far proven that it is. It hasn't talked about this law in terms of the First Amendment scrutiny and the specificity that the First Amendment requires.
So what then would be a more appropriate solution?
Well, there's a few things. One of the reasons it's hard to talk about what a better solution would be is because the justification for this law keeps on changing. Up until yesterday, maybe, those who support this law have been very strongly saying that this law is not about not about the content on TikTok at all. This is all about just some national security threat that we can't really tell you about, that it's just dangerous for China to have all this data about U.S. users. I think what we saw from your interview yesterday and from a lot of the statements made on the floor today, that this is very much concerns about the content that U.S. users get from TikTok. We heard this yesterday. I believe Representative Krishnamoorthy talked about how in China they get content about healthy living and STEM education, and in the United States it's about drug paraphernalia. and over-sexualization. So this is, we know this is clearly about content. It's very difficult under the First Amendment for the government to restrict content. So if the goal of this bill is to say, we don't like the content you're getting, that's a very difficult thing for the government to do.
So if TikTok is forced to divest, how does that infringe upon one's First Amendment rights? Because if I want to post on TikTok, I can still post whatever I'm posting, no matter who owns it.
Well, there's two things that could happen, right? One is that it will just shut down. It won't have a non-Chinese owner. That could happen. Then those who previously used the site and received information from it wouldn't get that anymore. If they're sold to a U.S. company or sold to other ownership, then that still may affect First Amendment rights because the new owners may have different editorial policies. In fact, it seems like, based on the comments of the sponsors gave on your show yesterday, is that they wanted to have different editorial policies. They wanted to show different content to U.S. users and to treat their content in different ways. So again, that's an infringement on the user's First Amendment rights. What Congress wants is for them to get different information. They're doing that through having different ownership and different editorial policies. I think we've all seen what a change in ownership can mean for the editorial policies of a social media company and for users' experiences with it and whether they want to engage with that service.
You and your organization have called instead for comprehensive data privacy legislation. How exactly would that work and how would that solve this TikTok problem?
So again, this really relies on if the problem is a data privacy problem, and this is what some people have said early on to justify the bill, a concern that too much U.S. user data was flowing to the Chinese government, and then that itself represented a national security concern. And we agree that the flow of U.S. user data is a serious problem, not just for national security reasons, but also for individual privacy purposes. But you address privacy concerns by passing privacy laws. What we do not have in the U.S. is comprehensive data privacy regulation that controls how much data companies can collect about their users in the first place, when to the extent they can retain such data, and how they can share such data. If companies, TikTok or anybody else, were not collecting and retaining and sharing so much data in the first place, you wouldn't need to single out TikTok for such exceptional treatment. It's hard to take Congress seriously about data privacy if they don't pass data privacy laws, if they don't look at how TikTok and other social media companies retain user data, and if they don't look at how data brokers then purchase and then redistribute that data to lots of actors, including governments and including our enemies.
David Green with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, thanks for your time and your insights this evening.
Thanks for having me.
In the day's other headlines, a judge in Georgia tossed out 6 of 41 charges against former President Trump and his allies in a 2020 election interference case. One of the dismissed counts involved Mr. Trump urging the Georgia Secretary of State to, quote, find 11,780 votes to overturn the election. But Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee found the charges too broad. He said, quote, the lack of detail concerning an essential legal element is fatal. Prosecutors will have the option of seeking a new indictment related to the dismissed counts. In the Middle East, 6 Palestinians have died in clashes across the occupied West Bank. A teenager was killed after he allegedly stabbed Israeli security guards. 3 others were shot dead after Israeli police said they were about to throw explosives. And 2 men were killed during an Israeli military raid in Jenin. Video of the aftermath showed roads torn up by Israeli tanks and bulldozers. Ukraine sent a new wave of armed drones into Russia today, striking at oil refineries. One attack set a large facility southeast of Moscow ablaze. Operations were reportedly disrupted at several other locations. Separately, Russian President Vladimir Putin was interviewed on state TV, and he said again that Russia could use nuclear weapons in Ukraine.
Оружие существует для того, чтобы применять.
Weapons exist to be used. We have our own principles. What do they mean? That we are ready to use weapons, including any weapons, including those you mentioned, if we are talking about the existence of the Russian state, about damaging our sovereignty and independence.
Putin spoke just days before national elections. He's expected to secure another six-year term. Officials in Lithuania called out Moscow today after an ally of the late Alexei Navalny was bludgeoned with a hammer. Leonid Volkov was assaulted on Tuesday. It happened outside the home where he's been living in exile. In a video posted online, Volkov appeared bruised and bandaged, but vowed not to be silenced.
They wanted to make me into a schnitzel with a meat hammer right outside my house. The attacker hit me 15 times in my leg. My arm has been broken, but I will live. The most important thing is we will continue working and we will not surrender. It was another obvious, typical, classic gangster hello from Putin.
The attack came nearly a month after Navalny died in a Russian prison, and Lithuanian officials made clear they think the Kremlin was involved. Moscow denied it played any role. In Haiti, plans for new leadership to rescue the violence-plagued nation appear to be in limbo tonight. Several figures tapped to join a transitional council now say they won't take part. The U.S. and Caribbean leaders had worked out the plan. Current Prime Minister Ariel Henry said he would resign once the council is in place. Here at home, an autopsy report released today concluded that Nex Benedict, a non-binary high school student in Oklahoma, died by suicide last month, a day after a physical altercation in a school bathroom. The report listed a, quote, combined toxicity of drugs used to treat depression and allergies. The incident sparked outrage from gay and transgender rights groups who cited reports that Nex had been a victim of bullying. On Wall Street, stocks mostly drifted on a quiet day of trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 37 points to close at 39,043. The NASDAQ fell 87 points. The S&P 500 slipped 10. And still to come on the NewsHour, a family in northern Gaza feeds hundreds of starving Palestinians during Ramadan. The FAA reports dozens of issues with the production of Boeing's 737 MAX jets. And the impact of America's deep political divisions on marriages, dating, and families.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The race for the White House is officially a rematch contest as the two most recent occupants of the Oval Office clinch their party's nominations and prepare to face off in a rematch of the 2020 election.
Hello, Milwaukee.
On his first day as the presumptive Democratic nominee, President Biden, in the battleground state of Wisconsin, touting his administration's accomplishments.
President, my predecessor, who failed the most basic duty any president owes the American people, the duty to care, just to care. In my view, that's unforgivable. I came to office determined to uphold the duty that gets us through one of the toughest periods in our nation's history, and we have. And now we're building a future America full of possibilities.
The general election matchup is now official.
We're the official nominee of the Republican Party.
After sweeping four states yesterday, Donald Trump secured enough delegates to become the GOP nominee for the third election in a row.
We have to get back to work because we have the worst president in the history of our country.
It's a rematch that some voters say they don't want.
I would love to see our country represented not by someone in their 80s who's a white man.
We don't have exceptional candidates right now, so it was a difficult decision.
Hey, everybody.
President Biden won 95% of the vote in Georgia last night and 87% of the vote in Washington state, even as nearly 50,000 Democrats there voted uncommitted.
I didn't feel comfortable giving him my support again, so I wanted to vote uncommitted today to send that message that people aren't just going to continue voting for whoever's in office as a Democrat, regardless of the action or inaction that they perform.
But other Democrats say the stakes are too high for symbolic protest votes.
I'm voting for Joe Biden all the way through. It really is an important election this year, probably the most important our country has ever had.
Donald Trump's diehard supporters also see the choice as critical.
I've never in my lifetime seen this economy
as bad as it is now. And I'm all for Donald Trump, and I want everybody to get out, and I want a red wave come November.
Go out and vote.
The now presumptive GOP nominee will spend at least part of his time in the coming days off the campaign trail. Mr. Trump will be back in federal court in Florida on Thursday, facing charges of mishandling classified documents and obstructing justice. And his hush money trial begins later this month in New York.
Because they assume you're here.
For both candidates, the focus will soon turn to those few battleground states where the final outcome could be measured in just thousands of votes, and what will be the longest general election campaign in modern history.
Let's bring in Doug High. He's the former communications director to House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, and before that, the Republican National Committee. It's great to have you here.
Good to be with you.
So Donald Trump, as you well know, he lost Georgia by fewer than 12,000 votes back in 2020. Nikki Haley last night won more than 77,000 votes, even though she quit the race last week.
Yeah.
We should say that a lot of those folks voted early. Georgia has early voting. But a significant number of that vote, that was a protest vote against Donald Trump. How alarmed should the Trump campaign be?
They should take this very seriously. And what we see with this is something I learned the week before in North Carolina. I happened to have been down in Chapel Hill at my alma mater, UNC. We're going to win the ACC tournament this weekend. And I went to a Nikki Haley event nearby in Raleigh. And what I saw was a room that was jammed. They had to move it to two separate larger venues to handle the crowd size. And there was something real going on in that room. And what I saw were a lot of people wearing T-shirts that said permanently barred. Now, some of those people are probably temporarily barred. They'll ultimately vote for Donald Trump. But if you're looking at a state like Georgia, if 20% of those who voted for Nikki Haley decide to not support Donald Trump, well, there's your 12,000 vote margin. It's a real problem for the Trump campaign, and pushing people away is not going to be the answer. You know, politics should be about addition, not subtraction. Whether you're in partisan politics or congressional politics, Donald Trump needs to learn that lesson this week and moving forward.
Well, on that point, I mean, for all of the hand-wringing, Doug, on the Democratic side about Joe Biden's political standing and his poll numbers, Donald Trump has not shown an ability or even a willingness to expand his base of support outside of his people who already support him. I mean, he has an unusually strong floor of support, but he has also an unusually low ceiling of support, and that's problematic. How does he deal with that?
Well, if you look at the polling trend for years now, Donald Trump has been relatively flat, and it's because of, as you say, there's a low ceiling but also a high floor. There's not a lot of places that he can go. What we're going to see Donald Trump do is two things, essentially. One, try to start to appeal to some of those voters that he very proactively turned off. Again, you are permanently banned. We don't want you. Well, he's going to have to say, we want you, come and join. How many of those listen are going to be a problem? The other is going to those people who don't like Donald Trump, but also don't like Joe Biden, aren't happy with the direction of the country, and think that Trump is better on a whole host of issues, whether that's the economy and jobs, inflation certainly, and the border. Those issues and a whole lot more, where Joe Biden is really deeply underwater, you're going to hear Trump talk about those more and more. Problem is, though, he's still Donald Trump. And so he's going to talk about those issues, but overshadow himself by talking about two-tiered system of justice, this judge hates me, that judge is unfair, this woman, that woman, insulting as many people as he can. That turns off those very voters that he needs.
I want to draw on your experience at the RNC because Donald Trump, as you well know, he has cemented his control of the Republican National Committee. The group's members voted to affirm all of his handpicked leaders, including his daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, who's now co-chair. It's unusual, not unheard of. Ronald Reagan's daughter was elected co-chair back in 1987. Still, though, with an RNC that is newly organized to support Donald Trump, what does that mean for Republicans who are running down ballot?
Well, I think that's where the concern will be. Laura Trump said, our number one priority is electing Donald Trump. In fact, that's our only priority. Well, if you're running for Senate or governor or House or other offices, you need to be concerned about that. But that's where you have the other party committees, the Congressional Committee, the Senatorial, and the RGA, working with the RNC to make sure that money is flowing to states in all directions. So unless you're from North Carolina, with Michael Whatley being the North Carolina State Party Chair and Laura Trump being there, you do have concerns about if money's going to be spent on other activities, whether it's legal bills or what have you, does that come at my expense? This makes the congressional committees and the RGA that much more important.
When you look at how the RNC has been hollowed out, mass layoffs, the installation of loyalists, including lawyers who worked for him, who helped spread lies about the election, all of that, one of whom has just been named the senior counsel for election integrity at the RNC, or Christina Bob. What does any of that suggest about the way Donald Trump would govern if he has a second term?
Well, some of that is business as usual. I've never seen a story that talks about Jamie Harrison being a Biden loyalist. Of course he's a Biden loyalist. When you're the DNC chair, you're a loyalist to your party and certainly your president. So a lot of this is very normal and is what happens when, or happened when Mitt Romney became the nominee or John McCain became the nominee. Some of this, though, a hollowing out of staff does cause concerns. We need to see more about, are they going to be smart with how they now redirect their money? Sean Carencross is somebody who has come on board with the RNC. He's in charge of making sure the trains run on time and that there's money for those trains. I worked with him. He was at the senatorial committee when I worked at the RNC. He is a pro's pro and somebody who's going to be very effective in that job. On the issue of, you know, election integrity, I think it's interesting. We often hear about polling that shows that voters are concerned about democracy. A lot of those are Democratic voters, of course. A lot of those are Republicans who think wrongly, but think the election was stolen from them. So it doesn't surprise me that Donald Trump is going to hire people who sort of subscribe to that worldview. That's what happens in politics.
Doug High, thanks as always. Great to see
you. Thank you.
Tens of thousands of unaccompanied children arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border each year, most coming from Central America. It's a long, often dangerous journey, and Amna Navaz spoke to a group of sisters making the trek alone, and she joins us now from the Arizona border. Amna?
Jeff, that's right. Just yesterday, in a remote stretch of the Arizona border with Mexico, we met three young girls, three sisters. Hennessy is 14, Nicole is 13, and little Valeria is just 8. Now, these sisters had just made the 1,500-mile journey from Chiapas in southern Mexico, where they called home, up to the U.S. border. Their mother had actually left years ago. She'd come to the States as the sole provider to support her family. The girls had been living with a great-grandmother who could no longer care for them, so they headed north to reunite with their mother. Here, in fact, is what Nicole told us about that trip.
How did you know where to go or who to go with?
We got to know a group and we started trusting each other and helping each other.
Why did you leave Chiapas in the first place?
Because it's too dangerous. There's a lot of drug trafficking and other stuff.
Jeff, as remarkable as it is to see three young girls who have made that very long, very dangerous journey on their own, these sisters are part of a growing trend officials tell us they are seeing at the U.S. southern border. More unaccompanied minors arriving there. In 2022, a record high of over 150,000. And like other people arriving at the border, they are coming from more and more countries. So we've seen some officials tell us they've seen unaccompanied children arriving from as far away as Egypt, India, and China. Jeff?
And these journeys are incredibly dangerous for anybody, let alone three young girls traveling without adults. What did the sisters you met say about that?
No, the girls in many ways are lucky, Jeff, because they traveled on planes and on buses and then on foot for hours. You know, we connected with their mother. We spoke to her on the phone and were able to talk to her, not only to get her permission to speak with the girls, but also to hear what she had to say. She said she felt she had no choice. She had to bring her daughters to her. She told them to stay calm and to stick together. I asked, actually, the youngest girl, Valeria, if she was scared at any point in the journey. Here's what she said.
Was it scary at any time? Was she worried?
Dime acerca del viaje. ¿Estuviste miedo?
No. No. ¿Por qué no?
¿Por qué no?
¿Por qué no? Because you were with your sister?
Porque estabas con tus hermanas.
You know, Jeff, when we met the girls, they had been out there for hours. They'd long run out of food and water. The humanitarian aid group we were with, the Green Valley Samaritans, offered both. But they were waiting for Border Patrol to come and pick them up. As unaccompanied minors, they would be prioritized. I should mention, when we left them, hours went by. Because of some confusion and a lack of Border Patrol resources, the girls somehow got left behind at the wall with a larger migrant group. Night fell and the temperatures dropped. It is pitch black out there in rough terrain. It's dangerous with the cartels coming through. And the girls, in a panic, called their mother, who called us. We were then able to call around to our contacts and alert Border Patrol. There were unaccompanied children still out there on the wall. They sent a car overnight to go retrieve them. But all of this just underscores how incredibly precarious this journey can be, even when the girls felt they'd reached safety in the United States. Jeff?
So what happens now, Amna, to those three young girls and to other unaccompanied minors who are making similar treks?
Well, for these three girls, there is now a multi-agency effort that's been triggered. They'll be passed into HHS custody, which has a system to care and house unaccompanied migrant children. They will vet their mother, hopefully reunite them in the coming weeks. We'll continue to follow their story. But the larger question you ask here is exactly right, Jeff. It's how is the U.S. going to continue to provide and care for what we know are a rising number of unaccompanied children who are now coming from further and further afield? It's just one of the many challenges at the border that U.S. authorities now have to deal with. Jeff?
Amna Nawaz, incredible reporting by you and your team there. We will see you back here tomorrow evening.
Thanks, Jeff.
Today, Israel's top spokesperson for the first time publicly suggested that Israel has a plan to evacuate many of the more than 1 million people who have fled to Rafah in southern Gaza. That comes as the U.S. continues to call on Israel to do more to allow humanitarian aid into the Strip. Nick Schifrin joins us now. So, Nick, let's start in Rafah. What plan does Israel have when it comes to attacking Rafah and then moving civilians out of harm's way?
U.S. officials tell me that there is no plan, at least one that has been presented to them. But as you said, Israel's top military spokesman, Admiral Daniel Hagari, said today that they have a plan to evacuate, quote, a significant number of the 1.4 million Gazans who have fled to Rafah. You can see some of the conditions that they're living in right now. And they would be evacuated, Hagari said, to, quote, humanitarian islands in Gaza. Hagari gave no more details than that. And the U.S. Officials I speak to, frankly, are very skeptical that this is actually a plan, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken reflected today.
There has to be, if there are going to be military operations in Rafah, a clear and implementable plan to get the civilians out of harm's way and to provide for them once out of harm's way. We have not seen that plan. Is it possible? Yes, it's possible, but we haven't seen it, and the most important thing is to see it. And to make sure that it's something that can be implemented.
U.S. officials I speak to, Jeff, are frankly skeptical that there will ever be a plan that Israel has to evacuate all of those people. But they do believe that Israel is serious about going into Rafah because Hamas's final four battalions are in Rafah, and Israel says it cannot defeat Hamas without defeating those four battalions, which leads to President Biden's warnings, U.S. officials' warnings about what would happen if Israel goes into Rafah, and what multiple officials I talked to say are considerations, just that, considerations right now of what to do if that happens. Everything from forcible statements to votes in the Security Council to, yes, conditioning the use or sale of weapons to Israel. But again, we're a long way from that happening right now.
Considerations. Okay. So meantime, the U.S. is still trying to get a hostage deal. What's the latest there?
Yeah. So publicly, all sides say that the talks are stuck. But CIA Director Bill Burns, who's been leading the U.S. effort here, has been in the region trying to find a path forward. And what U.S. officials fear is that Hamas is biding time, essentially hoping that during Ramadan, Israel, whether in Gaza or Jerusalem, makes some move that would inflame Palestinian or Arab opinion and therefore alleviate some of the pressure that is being put on Hamas, especially by Qatar right now. Part of that is that Hamas wants the world, wants the focus of Gaza to be on the humanitarian crisis there.
A humanitarian crisis that is very real.
Very real, especially about food. The UN says all of Gaza's 2.2 million people are in, quote, food crisis. And the UN says one quarter of Gaza is one step away from famine. So as the holy month of Ramadan begins, there is simply not enough food to go around.
There is fasting and there is starving. Many Gazans say they are now doing both. At this soup kitchen in northern Gaza, families struggle for a small pot of soup. Before Ramadan, this was most of these Gazans' only meal, sustenance to stop starvation. During Ramadan, it is the meal that breaks their fast, cauldrons to feed a community. Mahmoud Al-Madoun is the soup kitchen organizer and head chef. His team filmed this for us. We spoke to him on Apache phone connection.
All day, people are waiting for us at the kitchen door. They can survive because of kitchens like these. They would starve without it.
Ramadan is about charity and family, and the Almadouns try to be generous together. Three generations prepare the food. 72-year-old Fatima starts her preps at dawn.
I get extremely tired, but I feel happy to see young children eat. It helps me sleep better at night.
Mahmoud's 11-year-old daughter, also Fatima, with her sister tugging at her shirt, has no school to attend, so she does the stirring.
I miss my friends and school and studying. I miss my home. I hope we can go back to the way it was before. My dreams are for the war to end and to become a teacher, and that we're safe.
But those dreams are deferred. This Ramadan is defined by displacement and deprivation. Most Gazans have fled their homes, and the UN warns Gaza is approaching famine.
People are stealing from each other so they don't starve to death. There are many kids who have been orphaned who come to me asking for food.
The starvation is real. The man-made famine is real, and we know families that are hurting.
Hani Almadoun is Mahmoud's brother and based in the U.S.
A lot of people failed the Palestinians, but the land did not because, you know, they could still find some potatoes. People could not go pick it, and it just kept growing and growing, and, you know, he'd be cooking whatever he can find. Is it enough? No, but it's good for our neighborhood and friends.
The Almadouns launched the kitchen in January for a few hundred locals with two big pots and seasonal vegetables. On the first day of Ramadan, they serve sizzling soup with a little lamb to thousands.
4 out of the 5 hungriest kids in the world are in Gaza right now. 5% of the people of Gaza are either killed, injured, or missing. So think about that. In my family, our table will have 6 less people this time.
Hani and Mahmoud's brother, Majid Almadoun, in the center, as well as his wife and 4 kids, were killed when their family home was bombed.
I feel sad for the loss of my brother. He's really my buddy and my sidekick, and he's not here anymore. We say we're resilient people, but that's gone beyond any level of resilience.
International humanitarian groups say the soup kitchen is only necessary because Israel isn't allowing enough aid into Gaza. Israel says it does not block aid and blames the shortfall on a lack of UN capacity. Last night, Israel opened a new truck route for the UN directly into northern Gaza, spokeswoman Tal Heinrich said today.
This was a pilot to prevent Hamas from taking over the aid, as they often do. There is no limit to the amount of aid that can be delivered into Gaza.
The U.S. will continue dropping aid by air, and the first aid ship is sailing to Gaza, ahead of next month's plan for U.S. soldiers to build a pier off Gaza's coast. But Israel must do more, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said today.
So, there's movement, and it's positive, but it remains insufficient. Israel still needs to open as many access points as possible and keep them open.
Traditionally, the aid is distributed by the UN Relief and Works Agency. Hani Almadoun is the director of philanthropy at UNRWA's independent American arm.
Israel, of course, accuses multiple members of UNRWA of participating in the October 7th terrorist attack and accuses UNRWA of effectively being intertwined with Hamas. Do you believe that's true?
On behalf of myself, I'm here in my personal capacity. I'm horrified by, you know, what I read in the news about those allegations. And I don't know. I just, you know, I want to repeat that feeding a hungry child should never be a political statement.
In December, Israeli forces detained Gazans whom they accused of being members of Hamas. Among them was Mahmoud Almadoun.
They humiliated us, stripped us, and took us over to the coast. We were on the sand all day in the cold. I thought to myself, we're not leaving here. We're going to die. When you think you're going to die and you don't, you want to start serving and helping others. It's like a new lease on life.
And the Gaza soup kitchen was born. So for the Almadouns, this Ramadan is about charity amid catastrophe. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
We're going to shift our focus now to the latest concerns around Boeing and aviation safety more broadly. The aerospace giant remains on the hot seat over important questions about its manufacturing and production processes. The head of the National Transportation Safety Board, Jennifer Homendy, told lawmakers her investigators still do not know who worked on the Boeing 737 door panel that blew off an Alaska Airlines flight back in January. At the same time, the New York Times reported this week that Boeing and a key supplier, Spirit AeroSystems, failed a number of recent FAA audits. Boeing reportedly failed 33 of 89 product audits. FAA Administrator Mark Whitaker was asked about that on Monday.
We've increased our audit and our oversight of Boeing pretty significantly since January 5th. If we see something that requires us to cease production or pull something down, we'll do that. But we're continuing that oversight, and we're working with Boeing and demanding that they come up with a very detailed plan within the next 90 days to fix the quality issues that are out there.
Equally unnerving, a series of problems on flights in just the last week, including several on United Airlines. There have been half a dozen incidents for United, including one flight that had to turn around after an engine caught fire. And on Monday, a flight from LATAM Airlines dropped suddenly and temporarily in midair en route to Auckland. The plane landed safely, but more than 50 people suffered injuries. One passenger woke up suddenly to the scare.
I look up, and he's full length, facing down, looking down at me. And I looked ahead, and there's another guy in the ceiling, and there's two people flying through the air, going across the aisles.
And let's bring in our aviation correspondent, Miles O'Brien. Miles, it's always great to see you. So let's start with Boeing. This Boeing audit conducted by the FAA revealed that the company failed large portions of that evaluation. The company failed 33 of 89 audits after that door panel flew off the Alaska Airlines flight back in January. Put that into context for us. What more can you tell us about that?
Well, Jeff, those numbers are kind of stunning. The Boeing CEO early on used the euphemism quality escape. That's a lot of escaping. And that causes a lot of concern about what's going on that factory floor at Boeing. But also, very importantly here, you have to ask the question, where was the FAA in advance of all this? Why weren't these audits ongoing? As we have discussed several times, Jeff, the FAA has moved to a system where manufacturers do their own inspecting. Obviously, we have a problem there with a conflict of interest, potentially. To the extent that there are FAA inspectors involved, in most cases, they're requesting and receiving paperwork, not necessarily putting boots on the factory floor and laying their eyes on potential problems. So when the FAA administrator says they need to rethink all of this, it's a big rethink because the way it is done right now clearly is allowing a lot of safety problems to escape into the market. And that's not what anybody wants to hear.
And the NTSB seems to be saying that Boeing isn't cooperating. How do you interpret the comments from the NTSB that they don't even know who was working on that door panel that flew off?
The NTSB would like to speak to the machinists that actually did the work on that door, which escaped from the Alaska Airlines flight. What happened? What did they do? What did they not do? What were on the checklists or not? And it's not a criminal proceeding. This is just an effort to understand what went wrong. This is how aviation gets safer. You learn from it and you make better rules for the future. But Boeing has so far blocked that effort. And you have to ask the question, why would the manufacturer do that? What wouldn't it be in the interest of aviation safety for those machinists to speak to the NTSB so that lessons can be learned?
We also learned this week that Alaska Airlines flight was scheduled for a safety check that same day the door panel blew off, and that there were engineers who were concerned about warning lights before that. You're a pilot. Are there cases where it's okay to fly when warning lights are going off?
Pilots have something called a minimum equipment list. It's the stuff that you can, that might be not working 100% correctly, but you can still dispatch and take off with. These lights on their own were in that list. In other words, you could fly and get it to maintenance in a reasonable course as opposed to grounding the aircraft. In retrospect, maybe that wasn't great. However, there was no other signs or symptoms of trouble with the pressurization system. And when I say that, either the crew or passengers would feel popping in their ears or hear a rushing of wind. None of that was occurring. So for all that engineer and all those machinists knew, it was just a bad sensor. And so the decision to wait until it got to Seattle, in retrospect, was probably an okay decision.
Here we are some 3 months later. Do we still know enough about the circumstances surrounding that Alaska Airlines flight?
We're getting there, but I mean, it would be, again, it would be nice to talk to all the parties involved, see exactly what happened, exactly what they were thinking. You know, everything that is done in aviation has a checklist, and the process of building aircraft are no different from that. This particular activity, taking off that door to fix some rivets, was not in the, you know, the system, so to speak. It was kind of an ad hoc move to make a fix. Those are the kinds of things, that kind of detail is really important to understand how that slipped through the cracks and how those bolts weren't put in place.
And Miles, amid all of this, a veteran Boeing employee, a prominent whistleblower involved in quality control, he died by suicide. What more can you tell us about his case and his deposition?
Well, John Barnett worked for a long time in the South Carolina plant for Boeing, which produces the 787. And his whistleblower case has revolved around quality control issues at Boeing. And at the core of his testimony is the idea that parts that were taken out of the production line by workers concerned that they weren't up to snuff and put off to the side were not properly evaluated, but rather were put right back onto aircraft that are now flying around the world. That's a big concern, and that deposition was a very heated one from the company officials. Now, what that might have to do with what happened later, we don't know, of course, but it's a tragic end to John Barnett's story for sure.
And as we mentioned, there have been a series of incidents involving United flights and others involving Boeing planes with different airlines. How concerning is all of this big picture?
Yeah, it's kind of all over the map, Jeff. You have cases where wheels are falling off. That could be attributed to maintenance. An aircraft taxiing off a runway, probably pilot error. An engine flame out, that's a manufacturer, CFM, that makes the engines. And then you have a 787, which had a precipitous fall between Australia and New Zealand. What drives that all together? It's hard to say, except I will say this. The aviation industry was clobbered by the pandemic. It lost experienced people in every quarter, on factory floors, in control towers, in cockpits, and the people that screw on the wheels to airplanes. All those places lost experience during COVID when people retired. And so this industry, which is rearing and back and people are flying, is struggling to keep up with all that. And it is worrisome.
Miles O'Brien, appreciate your insights as always. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Jeff.
For many Americans, politics has become far more personal and divisive than it once was. And now, in the run-up to the November election, that's creating some friction in families. Tonight, Judy Woodruff looks at the impact of politics on marriages, dating, and families as part of her ongoing series, America at a Crossroads.
For the Glasgow family, politics is never too far from home.
Whom are you voting for?
I'm going to go with Biden.
I will go for Donald Trump.
Joe Biden, all the way.
Hillary and Matt, who were married 9 years ago, have always butted heads, even making light of it in their wedding vows.
I said that something about still loving him even though he votes wrong.
Yeah.
Because he does.
I thought it was funny.
Yeah, we laugh.
Hillary is the executive director of Colorado Winds, a labor union representing more than 24,000 state employees. She's always been a diehard liberal.
No, as long as I can remember, I've been a Democrat.
Her husband, Matt, is on the opposite side. He voted for Donald Trump.
I don't know. He's probably not that nice of a guy. But I think that, like, overall, his policies probably have my best interests in mind. Yeah.
And he says he'll vote for him again in November if he's the nominee.
Like, the economy was good. I mean, it was.
Both admit it's led to shouting matches.
It comes out of nowhere.
It comes out of nowhere. It does get heated. We have big fights. We've heard that there are people who are opposite parties and they just avoid the topic. I don't understand how people do that. Because politics is a big deal to me, so.
The Glasgows are part of a small minority in America that's growing even smaller. Marriages between Democrats and Republicans. This polarized time when politics have become so personal has led to fewer people dating and marrying people with different views. And it's one factor in a decline in marriages, period, which have dropped by 60% since the 1970s.
People are waiting longer and they're just foregoing marriage. And part of the, I think, the challenge for young adults today is that they're often kind of in different ideological camps.
Brad Wilcox, the director of the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia, studies the impact of marriage on society.
A much larger share of young women who are in the sort of progressive camp, it's more than doubled since the early 1980s, of women who are kind of identifying as liberal in that 18 to 30 bracket. And then you've seen a modest uptick in the share of young men who are single who are identifying as conservatives. There are a lot of issues that are kind of dividing Americans now, and that makes it harder for people who are Republican to sort of like, you know, live with their Democratic, you know, family members and vice versa.
Political tension wasn't something Carol from Michigan expected to face with her husband.
You know, the day after the election in 2016, my husband was working in Italy, and I called him because I've never been political. I'm just an anti-news kind of artsy gal. And I called him and said, Hillary lost. And I was absolutely in tears. And he said, well, of course she should have. And I was like, uh-oh, here we go. And that was the beginning of realizing what his beliefs were versus mine.
In an effort to find support after Trump's election, she started a private Facebook group, Wives of the Deplorables, a tongue-in-cheek name drawing on a comment by Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton in 2016. A handful of the group's 175 members spoke to us, but didn't want to use their last names.
I think that politics weren't discussed as intensely, at least in my experience, before the 2016 election. Like, I think that I knew he was a Republican, I was a Democrat. I had no idea that these are some of the beliefs that he had, and that's very hard to stomach.
Most of these mixed political marriages have survived, while some ended in divorce. But the 2016 election was a turning point for them all.
I needed other women to talk to help, who are in similar situations, to help talk me through it, to figure out strategies to get to, you know, a common ground again.
If you look at the group, you will hear a lot of pain that women are struggling to be able to maintain their relationships. And in some cases, they're not able to continue. And this is the way of the world right now, you know, with friends, with relatives, you know, polar opposites, different silos, not willing or able to listen to each other.
These political tensions aren't just with married couples. Brad Wilcox says many young Americans are choosing to only date people with the same political views. A recent survey found 81% of respondents would prefer not to date across the aisle when it comes to serious relationships. That's a poll published by Newsweek last year.
So there's an undersupply of liberal men for liberal women, and there's an undersupply of conservative women for the conservative men. You know, we are seeing a larger minority of folks having difficulty finding someone who, you know, fits their worldview.
The Glasgow's 22-year-old daughter, Chloe Chigro, a college student, is one of those young people.
So I think it really is a case-by-case basis.
So there are issues that you would say, if somebody has a different view from me on
yes.
this, that would matter.
Absolutely. Reproductive rights, LGBTQ plus rights, immigrant rights, really just like if people of color, like Black Lives Matter, that's a really important movement for me.
I think conservatives definitely need to stick together.
John McEntee, a political advisor who served in the Trump administration, created a dating app for conservatives called The Right Stuff.
We're sorry that you've had to endure years of bad dates and wasted time with people that don't see the world our way.
We knew there could be a market for it, so we took it to an investor. He loved the idea, and that was 2 years ago, and we're off and running.
Do you think that's good
for all of us in the long run to be separated this way? If you match up in this day and age and you don't agree on a lot of the main themes and the main values, it's going to end poorly and maybe in disaster. So stay away from that. You know?
But Brad Wilcox says in the past, mixing politics and relationships has been beneficial to society.
Marriage has tended to sort of bridge the sexual divide, has tended to bring men and women together on a number of different fronts, including on the sort of political front. There, you know, many marriages back in the day where you had, you know, a Democrat and a Republican getting married and then that moderating their approach to life in general. Whereas today, because of this more polarized context, people are tending to marry along similar lines.
So the consequences you're saying are greater than simply they can't find a date for Saturday night.
Jefferson talked about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And what I think people don't always realize is that sort of what happens in our love lives and what happens in our families matters not just for ourselves or for our kids, but for the wider country or for our neighborhoods and communities.
And even when there are profound disagreements in those connections, some couples have figured out how to turn the focus to what brought them together in the first place.
We used to scream at each other outside in the hot tub. When politics came up, literally, and where we live, everyone can hear you. And we just this last couple months, we were like, this is a politics-free zone.
Humor has saved us now. Humor. We can now get through a disagreement in about less than a minute by we kind of make the other person crack up.
Others acknowledge repairing fractured relationships will just take time.
It took us 7 or 8 years to get of all this anger. It's going to take us a while to get back to where we were and hopefully improve our relationships and be better off for it. But it's going to take time.
For the Glasgows, their secret for happiness across the divide is focusing on what they have in common.
I firmly believe, like, legitimately, everybody wants what's best for everybody. And if you come from that position, I just disagree the path that she sees. That's it. Politics is a big part, but, like, so are the kids. So are, like, everything else, which, so are our interests. So are the things we like about each other. So are, you know, so, I mean, that's more than who I voted for.
So if we can figure out a way that we can all still love each other despite big differences like that, I think that, that's important.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Judy Woodruff in Pueblo, Colorado.
Remember, there is much more online at pbs.org/newshour.
And we'll have much more coming soon from the U.S.-Mexico border, including a closer look at how U.S. authorities are dealing with unprecedented border challenges. That's coming to the NewsHour soon. But that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz in Nogales, Mexico.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Thanks for joining us, and have a good evening.